You're listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
Good evening. Thank you for coming to the Open Society Foundations. I'm Stephen Hubble of the Open Society Fellowship Program. Privacy occupies, as we all know, an ambiguous realm somewhere between an inalienable right and a public good. Though the Constitution does not explicitly mention a right to privacy, scholars have detected its antecedents in the Bill of Rights, chiefly in the First, Fourth, Fifth, and Ninth Amendments to the Constitution, as well as the 14th. And those amendments laid the basis for subsequent Supreme Court decisions in Griswold and Lawrence and others. But if privacy is a right, especially in this new digital age, what sort of right is it? Is it an absolute right or a context-specific right? Is it a moral right, or should it be a statutory right? Or is privacy what's left over once all legitimate claimants to information about our personal selves have staked out what they needed? These and other issues will be addressed by our panel tonight. We subtitled this panel, Four Views of Technology, Democracy, and Security Online. And in doing so, I think we erred, because it should have been five views in deference to our distinguished moderator, Brendan Greeley. During his years at The Economist, Brendan originated the technology and policy beat, which placed him among the most influential reporters on the issues that we're going to discuss here tonight. He's now at Bloomberg Business Week, and we're thrilled to have him moderating tonight. One thing that we've learned in the past 24 hours is that when you invite the General Counsel of the Federal Bureau of Investigation to attend your event, there is a very real danger that he will be called away on urgent business to Washington. That's precisely what happened with Andrew Weissman. We are delighted, though, that in his stead, Deputy General Counsel Elaine Lambert has agreed to sit in. So thank you very much, Elaine, for appearing on very short notice. Thanks also to former Open Society Fellow Evgeny Morozov, current Open Society Fellow Chris Segoyan, Jane Yakowitz of Brooklyn Law School, soon to be of University of Arizona. And over to you, Brendan.
What I thought I would do briefly before we got into it is sort of frame why it is that we're here. The most obvious answer is that Steve asked us to come, but I think that we don't know how to talk about privacy. And when I say we, I mean citizens and consumers, and I absolutely mean journalists. It is very complicated. And as with all complicated subjects, we lean on heuristics. We sort of make decisions based on dramatic simplifications of what's going on. So if you look at sort of all of the things that you're supposed to read in the news about privacy, there are FTC actions against Google and Facebook, there's the Ad Council's Do Not Track proposal, there's the Cyber Intelligence Sharing and Protection Act. These are very complicated things. And so I suspect that we look at these things in the same way we look at taxes and regulations, in that we sort of vaguely know how we feel about them. It's pretty predictable how we're going to feel about them based on our political leanings, and we leave it to that. And I also believe that there's a suspicion, and I suspect that that's true in this room probably more than it is out on the street, that the more privacy that we can have, the better. So I know that that's often the way I feel, and I think that that's probably an inadequate way to look at it. I think, as with taxes and as with regulations, we want as little regulation as possible. We want as little tax as possible, and it's the as possible that's complicated. And I think we also want as much privacy as possible. And so it's the as possible that we're here to try and figure out. We're not going to agree at the end of this debate. We're not going to come to a conclusion. Which is sort of why I kind of hate Oxford Union-style debates, and I'm thankful that this is not one, because you start with a resolution, resolved, God is dead, and then you have an hour to figure it out. We're not going to get there. But I do think that what we will get by the end of this, what I hope that you get, and if you don't get it by 7 o'clock, please ask for it in the questions between 7 and 7:30, is a way of thinking about this. Privacy issues are going to be coming up in the news. You're going to have to make decisions about them for the next 30 years. So what I would hope to impart is sort of ways of making decisions rather than the decisions themselves. You have in front of you some of the smartest people thinking about privacy. They're people that I read often to try and help figure it out. But what we're going to do is, as I said, I suspect that most people here probably believe that more privacy is a good thing. And I'm going to start with two people who don't necessarily agree with you. One, because it's more fun that way. Two, because they have changed my mind a little bit, and I hope that you have a chance to let them change yours as well. Jane Yakowitz is a visiting assistant professor at Brooklyn Law School. She will join the permanent faculty at the University of Arizona this summer. She served as a research director of a research project at the UCLA School of Law, where she conducted quantitative research on higher education and negotiated the release of new public research data sets. Most important for us today, she's also the author of the essay Tragedy of the Data Commons, which has caused many people, including me, to think differently about privacy. Jane, I thought maybe you could lead off by explaining what the Data Commons is.
Sure. Yeah. So the idea of the Data Commons is that all of the massive accumulations of data that make us so nervous are also the seeds of giant public research databases that indirectly make our lives much better. So all of the quantitative, or at least most of the quantitative health and policy research today relies, at least to some degree, on these large public research databases. So the idea of the Data Commons is that if we pool our information together, we can learn much more about all of us without, if it's properly de-identified at least, without risking too much privacy risk for any of us. And the reason I believe that the Data Commons is so crucial and vital for us to preserve it is that it provides some information justice. It shows what no one of our experiences can show on its own, right? So detecting discrimination requires pooled data, and figuring out whether a law actually has the effects that it was intended to have requires data. So a lot of the laws and privacy proposals that are most popular today focus on giving people control of the data that describes them, and especially in the context of de-identified research data, I think this is a very bad idea and a very troubling one, that we might be able to drag our data out of this sort of data commons and prevent this very useful research from going forward.
Can you offer some specific examples of data sets that have helped us solve a problem that would not have been possible, that would have only been possible in the aggregate?
Yeah, sure. So one example that I use in the paper that I sort of like is the dating profile data that OkCupid collects. So they did a kind of neat study showing the likelihood, first of all, the likelihood that people are well matched, sort of in terms of their interests and other demographic variables. And then they show the likelihood that people will actually respond to a note that's sent to them. And it turns out that there are massive disparities by race when we look at the response rates. So that's one example. Another recent example is that the data collected on all cases that eventually could have led to capital punishment in Connecticut were used to show that state had such bad racial bias in the outcomes of capital punishment, both the decision of the state to pursue capital punishment and then also the outcomes themselves in terms of how juries decided, that the state of Connecticut recently decided to abolish the death penalty. So these are real consequences from data that describes, sometimes in identified form, the victims and the particulars of various events that were needed, though, in accumulated form in order to understand what's happening at a societal level.
Let me jump back in, actually, with a piece of housekeeping. I was hoping to tell everybody else you should reserve the right to jump in at any point if you vehemently disagree with something that's being said, and I will reserve the right to tell you to hold off if I feel like we're getting somewhere. But let me sort of follow up on that. It seems like there are two different kinds of data sets that we're talking about, commercial data sets and government data sets. And we have a lot more control. I don't know, maybe even that's arguable, but in some way we can sort of push for laws that give us control over the government data sets, whereas the commercial market is much harder to manage. Can you talk a little bit about the difference between in value between government data sets and commercial data sets?
Yes, yeah, although the data tends to be different in quality because of the way we interact with the government versus the way we interact with corporations, both are extremely valuable in their ability to provide insights for how people are and how they live and how and what determinations are being made on them. The difference, though, is that we have very little, a researcher has very little right to access any collection of business data. And meanwhile, corporations, though, we have a fairly laissez-faire privacy policy in the U.S. When companies or when private actors are holding information. And so we end up with sort of perhaps the worst of both worlds, if you want to look at it pessimistically, when we're talking about data that's in private hands. So they can decide which researchers use it, which might determine, and perhaps they could decide even what questions are asked in order to and applied to the data sets, whereas the government, if we're able to access data through FOIA laws or whatnot, the government obviously can't say what research questions are verboten. However, increasingly, the government is getting shrewd about using both privacy and trade secret and other exemptions from FOIA in order to thwart access to data that's held in its hands. So the reason I wrote the article I did was I see a trend toward less access, both on the private and public side, using the privacy as a justification that I don't think is entirely honest.
So you wrote this article last year. It was published in the Harvard Journal of Technology and Law. And for those of you that don't know, the Harvard Berkman Center is sort of the Church of the Holy Trinity of privacy, open standards, and net neutrality. So what kind of reaction did you get to this article? Because it says a counterintuitive thing, I think, about privacy.
The reaction I got from the research community was, well, duh, because these are people who always use databases. They thought I was sort of, perhaps, stating the obvious. I don't think they entirely realized that the obvious needed to be said, though. The reaction from the privacy community and perhaps the public at large has been, I think it's been, it's been somewhat negative, in part because there have been studies, re-identification risk studies, that have gotten a lot of national attention. So the Netflix Prize data set was in the news for a few years when a couple researchers were able to re-identify two of the people in the Netflix Prize data set based on their IMDb profiles. And there have been a couple other re-identification studies, too. The onus has been on me and other researchers to show that the risk is theoretically lower than you might think and practically non-existent. These re-identification attacks actually do not happen. But
so I was wondering how do you go about deciding whether or not a data set should be released? You still have to make a decision at the end of the day, yes or no, or yes with limitations, or how would you suggest that we go about looking or wondering whether data sets should be released or not?
Well, for research purposes, I think we should really only ask two questions. First, if it's easily re-identifiable or even moderately easily re-identifiable. It's actually not that easy to, in practice, to re-identify data sets based on public records for reasons that probably are too technical and not worth explaining here. But in any case, I do think that we should at least put some effort into making sure that it's hard to re-identify a data subject. And then the second thing, I think that we can can design law to put obligations on researchers and others who access the data to not attempt to re-identify it unless they are producing re-identification risk research, in which case, you know, if they do make a re-identification, they can only tell the holder of the data set about the risk. So I actually think that today, if someone were to re-identify a data set for nefarious purposes, I do think that there's some common law that could help, you know, the tort of intrusion upon seclusion, et cetera. There are some tools that could help punish the person anyways, but we might as well make it overt that we do not expect people to re-identify research data sets.
So I'm going to ask Chris and Evgeny to respond to something that was in the paper, Tragedy of the Data Commons. There's this delightfully abstract noun, malfeasor, that keeps coming up, which is, you know, the bad guy who might do something with this data. And you had trouble identifying who the malfeasor might be. Is that, and I'm wondering if one or both of you could take a stab at defining a malfeasor.
Sure. I think the logical one is easy. It's the government. Right? The government is an entity with a gigantic amount of data crunching resources, a huge budget, and easy access to all of our data. More importantly, what the government does stays behind closed doors, and so we never know what they do with our data. We never know when they re-identify previously quasi-anonymous data sets, right? It just happens behind closed doors, and maybe one day, you know, you get stopped at the border. Maybe one day you get pulled from your house in the middle of the night, and you don't know why that happens. You don't know if it's because they were given a tip or because some really crappy data ended up in a database. And this happened to one gentleman, at least this happened to many people, but it happened to Mahar Arar, who was a Canadian citizen who was deported to Syria and tortured because of bad data that had ended up in a US government database. And had he not been tortured, he wouldn't have known that that information had ended up in a database. So, I mean, there is a legitimate threat of the government's use of this data, and you cannot FOIA NSA or CIA databases. They do not disclose them. I've stopped bothering to even file requests with the NSA.
I also think that that question is hard to answer without knowing what kind of data set we're talking about. I mean, there will be all sorts of data sets, say, about books that I like. The books I put on, you know, my Amazon wish list, I think actually public, unless I specify otherwise. So that data set is easily available. But if you're talking about readings or even, you know, film, I can imagine then, you know, people interested in a particular film or book would be of interest to all sorts of non-state actors who may want to recruit them for some tasks or who may want to punish them for holding certain views. I mean, there are all sorts of non-state groups that will be interested in that data. But again, to understand the malfeasor, we need to know the context and the data set. Obviously, weather data will be different from books data, and that will be different from, you know, toys data. So I can see why you had a problem identifying the malfeasor. I mean, it will be different depending on the data.
But I mean, it gets even more complicated than that because you identified books as something that might be a little more benign, that might be harder to extrapolate something from. But this is, I mean, the right to not reveal or the obligation to not reveal books that are checked out is something that librarians go to the mat for and did in 2002. So, I'm sorry, Jane.
So if I could respond quickly. Right. I think both of those examples don't seem very realistic to me, precisely because there is so much identified data that is easier to access than the process of re-identifying a data set, which is usually some subset of a broader community. So the government, I mean, I don't know why they would re-identify a de-identified data when they could just subpoena the records if they exist. Any company that wants access to Amazon's full database could negotiate with Amazon or some other, you know, retailer.
But let's say I want to start a terrorist group and I need to recruit 20 new members. And, you know, one way of going about that task would be to look at who purchased book X written by a certain cleric. And I want to know who are the people who purchased it. So I would be very interested in identifying who those people are and then approaching them online, offline, or through some other means.
Let me jump in here and say first that I fear the activities of Evgeny's terrorist group when he starts it. I think they will be incredibly effective and terrifying. And Chris identified, you know, I asked for a Malfeasor, and Chris gave me one. He gave me the government. We have the government right here in the room.
an introduction.
I promised her off mic that I wouldn't throw her to the wolves, but the transition was just too much fun. Elaine Lambert is the deputy and chief of staff to the general counsel of the Federal Bureau of Investigation. More than that, she's a good sport because, as you know, she was thrown into this today. You wanted to talk about two concerns that the law enforcement community has about the desire to protect as much data as possible. And the first of those is the process of having people go dark. Can you explain what that means?
Sure. The term going dark is basically explaining the fact that we have a gap, a widening gap between our authorities to collect information, whether we pursue it through a criminal wiretap, such as the Title III, or a national security type of wiretap. So the ability that we do get a court order to be able to collect information and the capability of actually being able to effectuate that intercept. Given with the advance of technology in the last few years, especially over the internet, such as you know social networks and webmail and things like that, there is a gap, a widening gap between having the authority to collect and the capability, actually the technical capability of doing so.
So what are the kinds of information that are going dark, that you're worried about, things that you might not be able to access?
So if there are communications occurring over any of these type of communication systems that exist either in the internet or so forth, if there's not a capability to capture that, even though we have the lawful authority to get it, we won't be able to get that information. And what that causes us, if we're not able to get things in real time, the ability of us to be able to fight a particular either national security threat or a criminal threat diminishes because we are behind the actions of those individuals that are perpetrating those particular threats.
So let me just, this stuff is sort of maddeningly confusing, so I'm going to try and make it as specific as possible. When you talk about a service that you might not be able to track, you're talking about, say, Skype, where you don't actually physically have the ability to tap a Skype conversation. Is that?
There are a multitude of types of communication devices that there might be a difficulty in capturing at this time.
Can you name a couple?
Nope. No, not at liberty right now to name those.
It's okay, because Chris
Good
will.
Good try.
How about what?
Tor. I'm going to put this on mic. There was a question from the audience on whether Tor interferes with your ability to chase down evildoers.
As it happens, from a developer of Tor, so that we know the context.
Excuse me?
As it happens, the question comes from the developer of Tor.
Well, maybe I should talk to him later then. Excuse me? Okay.
Come on, Jake. We'll get into this in the Q&A.
Okay. Well, we will get there. So one of my questions about the concern that you have about going dark is that it seems like 20 years ago we were all dark. This kind of information just wasn't available, period. So if we are going dark again, having been dark and then gone light, if you'll excuse the metaphor, what is the danger of returning to a set of law enforcement tools that you had in 1985 before all this information could be captured in the first place?
I don't think your premise is, it might be a different premise.
Oh, good, so I love
maybe,
answers
maybe
like this.
Maybe I need to clarify what you're asking.
Please.
Back in, you know, the 80s and early 90s, we had sort of, you know, the internet was very nascent. Right, so it was just starting. It was, you know, and so most of our communications were over sort of regular telephony and things along those lines. As a matter of fact, even then, when we started having some sort of need to have technical capabilities in place, the CALEA, the Communications Assistance for Law Enforcement Act, was passed to assist, you know, law enforcement and providers to understand what kind of capabilities needed to be in place. So when we showed up with a lawfully acquired court order, they would then have the ability to assist us, as these statutes require providers to do, assist us in capturing the information that we had a court order to be able to capture. What has happened since then is obviously, you know, technology has advanced, modes of communication have advanced, and providers have not necessarily put into place capacity to be able to help us execute our orders. And so that is the widening gap that we're talking about. So it's not so much that, I'm not sure I'm understanding your question. I don't know if I helped explain it by saying
Can I help with a clarifying question?
Please.
Sure.
So it's very rare that the FBI will explain the products and services that you have trouble intercepting. But from my understanding of conversations in DC, some of your difficulties relate to the fact that under Electronic Communications Privacy Act, you can request stored records from a company like Google. You can go to Google and say, tell us everything that Chris searched for yesterday, but there's nothing that allows you to go to Google and say, tell us in real time what Chris is searching for in the future. And so Google doesn't, my understanding is that Google does not have prospective surveillance capabilities. My understanding is that Facebook does not have prospective surveillance capabilities. My understanding is that several other internet-based services do not have prospective surveillance capabilities. Now, they certainly receive a hell of a lot of requests for stored records after the fact. And if anything, we are living in a golden era of surveillance where it's easier than ever to get access to store records. But you can only get things 10 seconds after they've been stored rather than in real time. Is that the problem that you have?
So we can acquire stored data with proper judicial process. I want to make sure that is understood. And secondly, we can go to a court and get the authority to be able to capture information real time. The question becomes whether the people we serve that order on can technically do that. Does that answer your question? Both questions?
let me ask. Right now, if you could lay out as much as you're able, what is the current procedure for requesting, for the FBI requesting information from, I'm thinking of two different entities. One is an internet service provider, and the other is an internet service, such as Google or Facebook. So let's start with the internet service provider. If you needed data, what would be the process that you would have to go through?
What kind of data?
Oh, God.
It's an important question.
It does matter. Okay. It does matter. He's absolutely right. It depends on what you're asking.
Oh, no, I'm certain that he is right. Maybe you can give me an example.
Relational versus substantial, whether it's the contacts you want to know, who the person talks to, what they talk about, because there is a difference between relational data and the actual content of the messages.
Why don't I try this? Let's see if this helps. So if we want to capture a conversation, some two people talking, whether it's over the phone or over, you know, the internet, whatever technology they're using to communicate, there are two statutes in place that give us tells us the procedures in which to obtain that authority. One is the Electronic Communication Privacy Act, absolutely, which encompasses also the ability to not only acquire stored, you know, communications and so forth. There's Title III, as I just said, of the Omnibus Safe Street Act, which basically is the wiretap that you hear a lot about. So we need to show to a court that we have probable cause to believe that the individual whose communications we're about to intercept has committed or is about to commit certain crimes that are predicated in that statute. In the national security world, we have the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act that does the same thing as the Title III. Probable cause to believe that certain communications are the communications of a foreign power. And so that's how we go to the provider for that type of information. So communications, wanting to know what two people are saying to each other. Having served that warrant, that court order, then depends on whether that provider has the technical capability of being able to provide that information to us.
So one of the... It occurs to me, I just want to leave a bookmark here to think about for the rest of the time, which is that I think maybe people in the audience are smarter than I am about this, and I'm certain that many of them are. I think I probably have a taxonomical problem when it comes to data, which is that for me it's all a big mass of, of data, and it's very hard to decipher, to figure out ways of breaking it down. And I'm sure each of you has a different taxonomy of data, whether it's corporate data and government data, whether it's sort of stored data or future data. It would be helpful for me, I think definitely, and probably everyone else as well, to figure out how it is that you would break down different kinds of data that we should be worried about one way or the other. But let me jump from that right into another question, which is that another thing that you said, or at least that the FBI is worried about, is the consequences of the Jones case. And I'm wondering if you can first explain what that was and what the consequences are for you.
Sure. The Jones case involved the use of a GPS, a global positioning device, a tracker on a car. We used the tracker to be able to follow the movements of an individual that was the subject of an investigation. The court ruled that whenever you commit trespass to acquire information on an individual, that will, you know, tell us about his whereabouts or her whereabouts. Whenever you commit that particular action, without any other exceptions to that trespass rule, you have to get a warrant. Previous to that, we did not have to get a warrant unless the individual was going into an area where he or she had an expectation of privacy. So the court now says it's the trespass action to acquire information that requires a Fourth Amendment warrant to acquire that information. In addition to which, the concurrence, it was a unanimous decision, but based on two different theories. The concurrence stated that not only that, but if you collect enough information over a period of time, and at that time it was the particular case was 28 days, that in of itself, so even if you potentially don't commit the trespass, if you're collecting data for more than, at least definitely for 28 days, we're not sure how much less than that the court would allow, that too would require a warrant under the Fourth Amendment to be able to obtain that information. So what that has done for law enforcement in general, not just the FBI, is that what previously, following a person's, movements in an area that was public, where everybody can see that person move. If we do it using a tracking device, we need a warrant. If we do it by sending a team of individuals to follow them, then you do not. So it does cause a difficulty for law enforcement in general from a resource perspective. And also because the level is probable cause, and the use of the technique was to actually determine more about a particular investigation to gather the type of information to go forward. And so it does cause difficulty for law enforcement in general.
I'm going to move on to Chris because I suspect that the two of them have been storing up things that they want to say. We should probably let them start saying them. A lot of what you know about privacy, you know because of Chris Segoyan. He is completing work on his doctorate in informatics at Indiana University. That's probably the least interesting thing about him. He developed a tool for Firefox that enabled customers to opt out of behavioral advertising. He served as the first in-house technologist for the U.S. Federal Trade Commission's Division of Privacy and Identity Protection. He was a student fellow at Berkman Center for Internet and Society, but that's distinctive only in the sense that you have to have gone to Berkman in the way that actors were all on Law & Order at some point or another. And he created the first prototype for Do Not Track technology that's now used by three major web browsers. I encourage you, if you haven't already, to read the Wired article about him, which is fascinating. So we already know that your fear about privacy is the most Orwellian fear, which is that government will use it. But I was wondering if you could take a look at the government in the United States and outline sort of specifically what your biggest fear is that some agency, the government, might do with the wrong kinds of data or too much access to the wrong kinds of data.
So before I answer that question, let me talk about the kind of data they get.
Sure.
Because I actually think that what we hear about going dark is not really that accurate. Certainly there are some things that the government's concerned about, but surveillance over the last decade or two decades has gotten easier and cheaper. So there's a fantastic court case that I'm a really big fan of called U.S. v. Garcia. It's by the Seventh Circuit from 2007. It's Judge Posner who wrote the opinion, and he says, technological progress poses a threat to privacy by enabling an extent of surveillance that in earlier times would have been prohibitively expensive, right? Easy, cheap equals more. And so 20 years ago, before the advent of GPS trackers, you needed a team of FBI agents to track someone around, right? You needed several cars because you didn't want the same car showing up in the rearview mirror, so they would change off every few minutes. And you, if you wanted to track someone 24 hours a day, you needed teams of agents 24 hours a day. Now, GPS devices have made it easier for the government to track people without those teams of agents, but GPS tracking under a car isn't the only way for the government to track you. In fact, it's not even the majority way for the government to track you. Post-Jones, I think we're going to see even more of my primary fear, which is cell phone tracking. We carry cell phones with us at all times, even when we're not in vehicles, and the government can get this data without a warrant. In fact, the government believes that they can get single cell tower data prospectively, which means in real time, with a relevancy to an ongoing investigation standard. It's a combined 2703D and pen register order. So 15 years ago, actually even 10 years ago, the phone company started offering real-time access to this data, and it was expensive because an analyst had to sit down at a keyboard and type a few commands to locate the tower. You Sprint and some of the other companies, their surveillance manuals have been leaked online, and we know that Nextel, which got bought by Sprint, used to charge $150 per ping. Fast forward a few years, Sprint was getting so many requests that they actually automated it. They set up a self-service website where law enforcement could log in at their convenience and get this information. This website cost $30 per month, unlimited use, and in the first year that it was set up, it was used 8 million times. This puts the 3,000 GPS trackers that were in the field the day that the Jones decision came out, in use by the FBI, not state or local law enforcement agencies, it puts that to shame. And that's just one carrier. And all the other carriers offer similar real-time location information at low cost and easy access. And to sort of riff on Alex Kaczynski, the chief judge of the Ninth Circuit, he describes the ease and convenience of a police officer spying on someone from the convenience of their desk, right? The police can now track 200 or 300 people from their desk. And what this means is that in years past, where resource constraints would have meant that law enforcement would have had to focus their investigations to only people who really mattered, now someone with the barest of suspicion can be tracked. Now, I think that the government does meet the valid legal threshold when they want to spy on someone, but unfortunately, the legal threshold is very, very low. And we don't have accurate data on how many requests there are. The phone companies don't tell us. The government doesn't volunteer this information. And so while we suspect there are hundreds of thousands of requests to carriers each year, we simply don't know the total number. But my fear is that we have entered a true and gigantic surveillance state, and we don't even know it. And with that data, we then have the possibility of so many horrible things.
So I hear you say, so forget the industry for a second, I hear you say that technology has made something cheaper and easier and more convenient. And as a business journalist, I go, great! Do you worry at all that we run the risk of halting innovation in law enforcement? I guess we're instinctively scared of what law enforcement does because of the power that they wield, but presumably we also want them to grow and adapt at the rate that private companies are growing and adapting as well.
Not only do they have more stuff cheaper, but they have access to data that they just simply didn't have in the past. Right? When I used to hold my documents on my own personal computer in my home, mm-hmm. they needed a warrant to get them. Now they can go to Dropbox and obtain them with a mere subpoena. Right? Not only they get the data with lesser legal process, I don't have the possibility of fighting them because I don't even know that they've obtained the information. And so the scale and the access to the information has grown.
So what limits would you place? How would you limit that? Something is going to have to limit that innovation. What what are the most effective ways, let's just assume that you could write the laws, that would still allow them the greater capabilities to track people, but with safeguards in place. What do those safeguards look like?
I mean, I think the first step is transparency. I don't think that, as long as Congress doesn't know how many requests there are, as long as Congress still thinks that there were 3,000 wiretaps a year and that's it, I mean, in fact, there are 3,000 wiretaps, it's just the government doesn't need to wiretap you to get your inbox from Google or to get your location data from Sprint or AT&T. As long as that's the only statistical data on surveillance, there will not be any pressure from the left or from the Tea Party on the right to pass comprehensive legislation. Without that data, we have nothing. And I think the first step is to get the data, and that should be bipartisan. And let me also mention that what I've been describing, that the vague numbers that we have, this is all in the law enforcement context. The rules are completely different, and there's so little data in the intelligence context. And not only do we not have any data, we don't even know which laws they use, right? So Senators Wyden and Udall have been freaking out because the DOJ has a secret interpretation of the Patriot Act, and specifically Section 215, and I would ask you, can you get prospective or historical location data with Section 215 of the Patriot Act?
I'm not even sure what you mean about that they're freaking out. Maybe you can explain that.
I mean, they've written op-eds in the newspaper. They've written letters to the Attorney General asking for copies of the OLC memo outlining your secret interpretation of the Patriot Act. I would describe that as freaking out.
Okay. I can't speak for the department. If they're not releasing that, that's, you know, I cannot speak
for
them.
Can you tell me whether you can obtain location data with a 215 order?
That's the subject of the opinion of the department. I cannot discuss it right now, right? I'd like to ask you a question. Is that
please.
Okay? I know you're in the moderator.
No. That's ideal. The less
okay.
I speak, the better off
we
all are.
I don't have a lawyer present, so I don't know if I'll be able to answer it.
That's okay. You seem very capable. So you seem to suggest to the audience here that the information is gathered without sort of any basis, or at least without, you know, with some limited judicial process. And so I'm just curious as to sort of what exactly you're basing that on. So if we want to get information on individual real time, obviously we need more than just a request where it's relevant. And so you're, you know, then you talk about things that are stored. Yes, that by statute requires not a wiretap type of order, but does require judicial process. And so I'm curious to see where you're seeing that the government collects so much information with very little or no basis for collecting it.
So let me give you a fantastic example. It's actually in the back of the room. So there's a gentleman in the back. He's standing up. His name is Jake Applebaum. He's the subject of a federal investigation. And DOJ has obtained information about his use of Twitter, likely about his use of Gmail and his ISP Sonic in California. In the case of the Twitter investigation, the government has argued that they do not need a warrant to get his historical IP address information, which would reveal his location because of the presence of terms in Twitter's privacy policy. Because Twitter says that they collect information in their privacy policy, even though there's no proof that Jake ever read the privacy policy, the government is arguing they do not need a warrant to get that information. So that, I think, is a fantastic example. But the other thousands of instances in which you get information about individuals, whether it's list of URLs, browsed search engine information, or tens, if not hundreds of thousands of location records without a warrant, I think are highly problematic. I think the problem here is that the word location doesn't appear in our privacy law. Our privacy law was written before people really had cell phones. And so the courts have struggled to try and figure out how this works. Now, DOJ has proactively decided that they will, as a safe bet, get a probable cause warrant for real-time GPS or triangulated data. But they believe that they can get single tower real-time data, which is increasingly accurate, particularly in your home where you have a femtocell, which is a very small tower given to you by your phone company. They believe that they can get that without a warrant. They're arguing this in the Fifth Circuit, in fact, right now. And I think that I think that Americans have no idea about the true scale of location surveillance. And I think if we required the same kind of warrant that the Supreme Court just required of you in Jones for the cell phone tracking, I think that would be a good first step.
Let me jump in here. I want to move down to Evgeny. I decided to have Evgeny Bat clean up here because, and I say this with great affection, Evgeny, your gift in public conversation is to appear at the end and say, you guys are all wrong.
I can say it at the start. We don't have to wait.
Evgeny is the author of The Net Delusion, The Dark Side of Internet Freedom. He's a former Open Society Fellow as well, and he's currently a visiting scholar in the Liberation Technology Program at Stanford University and a Schwartz Fellow at the New America Foundation. He's also written in pretty much everything that you read, and I have to say, speaking as a technology journalist, that one of the more frustrating developments of the last 5 years is having to go from somebody who calls up Evgeny and says, what's going on, to having to read Evgeny and other publications writing about what's going on. So I have some questions for you, but you've been taking notes this whole time, so why don't I just let you respond?
Sure. So I got into this business of thinking about privacy and what the government in this country is doing through a very indirect route. I've been mostly focusing on practices of internet control in authoritarian states. And I remember distinctly reading a story in September 2010 in the New York Times about FBI's director Mueller going to Silicon Valley to talk to technology companies like Facebook and like Skype and to make sure that they build backdoors into the systems which will allow the kind of real-time access that Chris has talked about. So the idea was there that there will be a way for FBI and a lot of law enforcement agencies to basically track what you're saying on Facebook, on Skype, and any other private communications in real time. And there was some pushback from Silicon Valley, which was understandable. There was a lot of pushback from technologists in Washington. I watched the story unfold in the international context, and of course, there was a lot of we like this word today, freaking out in the international community where, you know, the governments of other countries did not exactly like the idea of America requiring American companies to build secret backdoors that would also allow America to spy or, you know, monitor, if you will, communications of their own subjects. Or, you know, now with the move to cloud computing, even of their own governments, right? There is a lot of data that's out there on Gmail and elsewhere run by governments abroad, and of course, people say in Iran or China, but I would assume even in Western Europe, who work for governments and elsewhere, were not particularly excited about this, you know, possibility. So there was a lot of pushback, and I think FBI made some statements that they're not actually seeking backdoors anymore. But I think what came to replace the idea of backdoors, at least practically, was a different method. So instead of trying to monitor what's happening on Skype, they would try to monitor what's happening on Skype through your computer. So in a sense, they would install malware on your machine. They will install, you know, they'll compromise the security of your computer. And instead of trying to break, say, Skype's encryption, they will try to monitor the sound on your computer. So they would be able to record the conversation without having to break Skype's encryption. So that was the method that I thought was the preferred one. The problem with this method that, you know, and this shift to users instead of platforms is that it has created an industry of technology companies that build such malware and such tools. And of course, here they're used, we hope, with some minimum legal oversight. But in other countries where such tools end up, they aren't used with any legal oversight. And as we discovered last year in Libya and in Egypt and in Tunisia, a lot of the tools that were developed to be used with legal oversight in this country, developed by American and European companies, ended up being used to spy on dissidents in Egypt or Syria or elsewhere. And that got me thinking about ways in which this debate about privacy and domestic surveillance overlaps and often contradicts many of the positions that the US government is taking with its internet freedom agenda, where in a sense you have diplomats at the State Department who are that we need to make sure that all dissidents in Iran or Syria or China are anonymous and enjoy full anonymity online, and we'll fund tools like Tor to actually give them this anonymity. But on the other hand, you have people sitting elsewhere in the government placing orders for software that then finds a secondary market in authoritarian states and is being used to undermine the very anonymity that the State Department is promoting. So this is how I got into this debate, because I was really interested in the contradictions in this discussion. And I think in a sense, there is a curse with both solutions. Because if you build backdoors, if you have American government demand backdoors into American services, then you have some kind of a cascade effect where the Indians, the Chinese, the Iranians, the Russians say, well, we also want backdoors. So now we want to make sure that either all American tools open up to our own governments, or we want to make sure that we don't rely on American tools. So instead of using, as you know, I think partly that was the case in Russia, where the government said, well, now we'll just be switching to open source technology. Forget Microsoft, Windows, and everything else. We want to be more secure, so we'll switch to Linux. Which, you know, is not a bad, I think, move regardless of the context. But I think this also poses all sorts of questions as to whether from a geopolitical perspective we actually want people in Iran or China or elsewhere to be using American services, because they'll be more conducive to freedom of expression and anonymity and dissent than the local bread alternatives. So with backdoors, there are problems. With this user-focused malware, there are problems because, again, it triggers an industry which is growing and which is very happy to cooperate with the dictators. There is very little regulation of what they do. And in a sense, this industry, technology industry, exists only because there is huge demand for such tools coming from FBI and other law enforcement agencies. And even in the domestic context, I would argue that such tools are often abused. And I'll pick Germany. I wouldn't pick the US, where in Germany there was a huge case last October where hackers and computer activists discovered that the German police was using one such tool, one such malware, which not only was recording and storing much more data than it was constitutionally allowed, but it was actually so insecure that it was possible for a third party to monitor everything that was happening. It was possible for the law enforcement to even plant evidence on a suspect's computer by using that software. Again, there are all, I agree with Chris here, I think we need to have a much more focused debate on, are those tools secure? Who else can be using those tools? Is there any scrutiny in how those tools are built and tested? I mean, those are important questions. And then there is this ethical, moral, geopolitical layer of where those tools end up once FBI moves on to the next tools, or once they have created this industry. And this ethical question hasn't been addressed in the domestic debate at all. And we keep treating internet freedom in the international context as completely separate from the domestic context. And that's something I think we need to bridge.
If I understand correctly, your concern is, and Chris's concern as well, is that if you have various internet services building backdoors, so law enforcement can use them as tools, you don't know who else is going to be wandering in the back door at some point. You can't unbuild the door. Is that your concern?
Well, that's one of the concerns, but again, there are many. I mean, I outlined the geopolitical context of how the governments will react to backdoors. But yes, I mean, that's the. But again, at this point, I'm not even sure that FBI's position is to ask for backdoors. I think, given how advanced malware is at this point, and we figured that out, by the way, only thanks to the Arab Spring, where we saw a lot of documents, we saw, you know, Egyptian activists who thought the Mubarak government would never be sophisticated enough to listen to the Skype calls, figured out that, well, there were actually transcripts of the Skype calls in Egyptian, you know, police headquarters, and they were there because probably Egyptian government bought such malware technology from Western companies. So we'd assume if this is possible in Egypt, this is also possible here. Again, the response from FBI and law enforcement is that here it's all under legal oversight, and in those countries it isn't, and that's sort of part of my problem with this.
So let me just mention, I have two favorite quotes from the old general counsel for the FBI. Valerie Caproni in September of 2010 told the New York Times, "No one should be promising their customers that they will thumb their nose at a US court order. They can promise strong encryption, they just need to figure out how they can provide us with plain text." Now the problem with that is there's no way to provide strong encryption and give the government plain text. Or if you can give the government plain text, there's no way to stop the Chinese government or the Iranian government or the Russian government from getting it too. You either have security from everyone or security from no one. And the policy of our government for the last 15, 20 years has basically been security for no one. We use our cell phones that have no encryption on our voice calls, and most of our data goes over the net unencrypted. The government can pick it off at the ISP. The FBI has Triggerfish and Stingray devices that they use to intercept telephone calls and track individual cell phones, taking advantage of the security flaws. The government has pushed back against any attempts to export encryption in the past and to minimize data retention in the present. My second favorite quote, and then I'll finish this up, is that this is from Valerie Caponi in February of last year, testifying at a CALEA hearing. There will always be criminals, terrorists, and spies who use very sophisticated means of communications that create very specific problems for law enforcement. We're looking for a better solution for most of our targets. And the reality is, I think, that sometimes we want to think that criminals are a lot smarter than they really are. Criminals tend to be somewhat lazy, and a lot of times they will resort to what's easy. So as long as we have a solution that will get us the bulk of our targets, the bulk of criminals, the bulk of terrorists, the bulk of spies, we'll be ahead of the game. But we cannot have to design individualized solutions for each sophisticated target, who's self-encrypting, putting very difficult encryption algorithms on for every target we find, because not every target is using such sophisticated communications. Now, what Valerie was saying then is that the FBI, at least then, didn't want consumers using technologies that had privacy by default and security by default. They want us to have our data in the clear so that if we're stopped, they can look through our phones and they can look through our laptops, and they don't want our communications to be flowing over secure links. Now, the problem is a world in which there's no encryption is a world that's great for identity thieves and for foreign espionage. There's no way to provide the FBI access and to keep everyone else out. And so as a result, we are all insecure.
Lynn, do you have a response to the two quotes that Chris just offered?
So I think the debate is illustrating that we want to be able to protect not only what, you know, obviously we as American citizens hold very dear, but we also want to be able to give our law enforcement, including the FBI, the ability to investigate and counter the threats that are coming in every day. And so what we are trying to do is to ensure that the capabilities are there, the technical capabilities are there for us to acquire information when we have the lawful authority to do so. And I think that's exactly what we are trying to do right now.
Let me move on to a question that I wanted to ask all of you, and I'd like to ask sort of each of you to answer in turn, but I'll throw it to Jane first, which is that something that Al Gore has said about the problem of global warming is that there are two different ways to look about it. You can look at it as a series of personal actions that can lead to a solution, or a series of political actions that can lead to a solution. That is, you can save energy on your own, you can use better sources of energy, you can walk more, or you can push for better legislation that helps solve the problem, or better public actions. And he's now of the opinion that personal action is not going to be the solution, that we can all individually decide to be as virtuous as we like, and unless we push for broader legislative and international action, it won't make a difference. So what we're talking about now, which is the values and drawbacks of having your data available to companies, to law enforcement agencies, should we think about this as a series of personal decisions, as in you can protect yourself by doing the following six things, or do we need to think about it as a political question in which you cannot provide for your own optimal security on your own, and you need to be active at the legislative level to help solve this?
Yes, I'm pessimistic that people have the sort of time or energy or wherewithal to protect themselves from threats of any privacy variety that are sort of predictable in advance and avoidable. And so when there is some sort of risk that is both avoidable and predictable, the legislature absolutely should step in and make sure that they legislate around it. That said, you know, outside the context of law enforcement, where I think our interests, the interests of the public are slightly different, I don't think that that harm is all that easy to gauge in advance. Rather, I think we have a natural, our natural state when thinking about new technologies is pessimism, great pessimism. And if we're inclined to regulate private actors in such a broad and sort of draconian way so that they are not able to collect new sources of information, not able to reuse information that was once collected for one purpose or et cetera, that kind of government action for me would be just as bad as the sort of surveillance that Chris is worried about. So you know, privacy law should be taken care of systemically at the legislative level, but that is not to say that we are in a state of crisis right now.
Elaine, the question's a little harder for you to answer, obviously, but I'm going to make you try and answer it anyway.
Sure. I think for us, we have to keep, technology is there, it's technology's good. It's, as you, I think, mentioned before, innovation. We don't want to quell or stop or thwart that. But we have to recognize that technology is used by individuals that want to do harm, whether it's in a criminal context or a national security context. And so we as law enforcement, we as a, as an intelligence agency, need to be able to have the ability to deal with those technologies when we have the right and lawful right to do so, to be able to investigate and counter those threats. And how that is achieved, you know, is something that is currently being looked at and worked on.
Chris? So I think that self-help is largely a joke because we don't control the data collection practices of the companies whose products we use. And in fact, we don't even have the opportunity to really lobby for their change, right? I don't get to meet with Mark Zuckerberg, but the FBI director gets to meet with him. And you know, I don't get to have backdoor meetings with the telecom companies and give them $500 million to pay for their cost of upgrading to CLIA-compliant equipment. Consumers do not have any control over the data retention practices of the companies, yet the government has both a financial incentive or financial method of applying pressure. And, you know, oh, you'd like a new license for some spectrum? Well, give us access. Oh, you'd like to merge with a company? Oh, well, then you need to maintain friendly relations with law enforcement. And so there is simply no way to get AT&T to stop logging your data. And there's simply no way to get Google to stop collecting data. You can try and hide yourself from Google so they don't know who you are. But I challenge you to try and find a way of hiding your location information from AT&T. The laws of physics do not allow you to hide the location of your phone from the phone company providing the service. You can try and pay for it in cash, but they know where you go each night, and they know where you go each day, and you're the only person who works at your home, works at your work and lives at your home. So I think the solution here, the failed solution is legislation, but so few people in Congress have any idea what's going on that we're not gonna get any legislative action, right? You have a single committee in the House and Senate, the Intelligence Committee, that might know what's going on and have been kept in the dark in the past, and neither committee knows the scale of surveillance activities in the law enforcement context. So we're not going to see any action until we have data and until we have whistleblowers who can actually provide the public with this information. And unfortunately, this administration is going after whistleblowers like it's going out of style. And unfortunately, it is going out of style.
Please.
So how about the Fourth Amendment or the courts as the institution to...
The courts have to have the opportunity to review things. And DOJ doesn't even appeal their losses, for the most part, at the magistrate level in the location space. They've appealed one case to the Fifth Circuit for historical cell tower data most recently. Or that's right, that was prospective single cell tower data. You know, the courts don't have the opportunity to weigh in, and DOJ is doing everything in their power right now to make sure that the courts cannot weigh in on the NSA wiretapping scandal either. I mean, the courts don't have the opportunity, Congress is in the dark, and we don't have a Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board, so we're screwed.
Well, that's good news.
Great. Good.
Yeah, but I'm not sure actually I buy into your analogy to climate change action. Because I think in the climate change example, you're actually talking about giving consumers or citizens an opportunity to engage in ethical consumption, you know, and stay away from things they think would undermine, you know, the environment. I think in the privacy case, legitimizing that dichotomy between individual and government action relies on a very, you know, I apologize for the word, you know, neoliberal outlook, where we actually expect the governments to do less and less and take on all of those functions and now start doing things that previously were actually provided to us by the government, which in this case will be privacy and potentially security as well. I remember having an event at Georgetown, and I had the gentleman from the Cato Institute, and Jake Applebaum, who's in the back, was there as well on that panel. And, you know, when that gentleman from the Cato Institute was asked, so what do you do about this extensive government surveillance? He said, well, but it's not really a problem. We can always speak in code on the phone. And he was absolutely serious about it. And I'm just not sure that's the that's a good way to go. But that's where that argument essentially leads.
I have to jump here in here and say, when I said that I hope that you would tell everybody who spoke before you that they were completely wrong, it had not occurred to me that I would be one of them.
And can I just briefly respond to Jane on the question of techno-pessimism? Like, where is that techno-pessimism? I really want to see more of it. You know, I wrote a book about techno-utopianism, but I don't really see that techno-pessimism. You know, I see people going to buy the latest iPad, the latest iPod, you know, Google self-driving cars, Google glasses, whatever. All of those are known to compromise privacy. All of those are known to have all sorts of cybersecurity flaws. Where is that cyber-pessimism? I mean, it may be somewhere in, you know, in academic circles, but I don't see it on the consumer level. I think as consumers, everyone is, you know, loves technology regardless of what privacy is. People will be continuing to share the music, films, books, articles, whatever, frictionless sharing as long as they get, you know, free credits to feed their virtual pets. I mean, that's the,
that's the consumer paradigm.
Right.
Well, the consumer, the mental model for the consumer is that they share in order to get their 40 cents off their pet food, and then the minute that information is reused for some purpose, some reason that they don't like, then they balk. So
why don't we see it happen on Facebook with frictionless sharing? Where is this great uprising of users?
It happens all the time with Facebook. You know, people log exactly where they're going, and or they take the day off of work and log where they're going, and then when the employer uses it or subpoenas, you know, asks for disclosure, then suddenly their privacy
why doesn't that lead to collective action then? So if there is this problem of, you know, techno-pessimism or techno, or, you know, phobia on behalf of consumers, why don't we see any effective collective action to demand those rights?
Well, no, I think we are starting to see it. So the FTC has been beating the drum for the U.S. privacy laws to start conforming to what the EU Data Protection Directive. The Obama administration too is you know, yielding to demands that that we get our FIPS and we apply FIPS, the Fair Information Practices Notice and Choice, all across the board to every single piece of data, and not, you know, not just the sort of traditional sensitive types of information like health data. So we are seeing it. I think we're seeing it right now.
I just don't see it on the user side. I mean, you take any technology, take facial recognition, you know, take any new feature that Facebook has introduced in the last 3 years. Its goal, in most of the cases, has been to limit our privacy and to expose more data. I don't see consumer pushback whatsoever.
Let me jump in, actually, because it seems like we've arrived at a very interesting point, which is that Chris said something earlier about sunlight. One of the first things that we could do is ask what the government is doing, what they're asking for, what kind of information they're getting, how they're getting it. And it seems like that could just as easily be applied to companies as well. But the two of you, and in particular Evgeny, you seem pessimistic about sunlight, that you don't think that there's enough collective action based on the things we already know, much less the things we might find out.
I'm not engaging in, you know, let's do more collective. Like, I'm not playing Al Gore in this panel, right? All I'm saying is that if there was a strong sense of techno-pessimism that Jane alluded to, we would see some kind of action coming from consumers and or users. And often we don't see it. And it may be that users agree with the premises of Facebook or Google. It may be that we are all, you know, operating under some false consciousness. I don't know. I just think that if there was a genuine feeling of techno-pessimism and users of those platforms really felt that something bad was happening, we would actually see more protests. And personally, I find that very disturbing. but, you know, with my intervention, I wasn't making, like, I don't have a PowerPoint to show you to rally up and go fight Facebook and Google at this point, no.
But consumers don't know what's happening online, right? So their tracking does not happen without the participation of the websites that consumers visit. The websites that consumers visit, let's leave the Googles and the Facebooks aside for the moment, but when consumers visit the New York Times or the Washington Post or Yelp or any of those sites are not tracking them. They're being tracked by third parties, by advertising networks and data brokers who are present on those sites. And those companies have been invited in. Some engineer from the New York Times has sat down and written code allowing 20 different third parties to track them, but that company isn't held accountable to it. There's nothing on the site that meaningfully informs consumers about the huge number of companies that are tracking them. And the company that enables it doesn't pay any reputational price for facilitating that tracking. So they just get a check at the end of the month, and they suffer no downside. And then Google and some of the ad networks that allegedly offer some degree of transparency by now showing consumers the sort of categories of information they have about you, they don't tell you where the data comes from. They don't tell you which first parties ratted you out to the ad networks. And I think without that missing component, without the ability to hold the first parties, the parties that consumers knowingly interact with, accountable, we're not going to have any change, because the companies that are doing the tracking are not consumer companies. There's no way to boycott an ad network. No one's buying anything from them other than the big brands. For the same reason that no one can boycott any of the surveillance companies, because we're not buying their products either. Consumer action only works against companies that consumers interact with and can pressure.
Seems like I'll jump to a second, but it seems like part of the problem is that there's a tacit deal that we aren't really aware of. When you go to a site that's free in any way, the tacit deal is you get this service, you get this content, you get this network for free, and in return, we track you. And sometimes I wonder whether if that deal were more explicit, if it were spelled out exactly what's happening. I think we should be terrified of things that are...
So there are two ways to think about it. One way to think about it is to say, well, consumers just aren't aware at all about this deal. We need to spell it out. And then they will realize how bad things are, and they will stop using the New York Times website because it tracks you. The other option, and I think the other way to interpret this, is to think that, well, consumers are aware of what's happening, and they just don't give a damn, which is a much more serious intellectual problem, because instead of relying on, you know, clarifying what's happening, you actually have to go and engage in arguments and show that maybe they're wrong about that tacit deal. And so my question to Chris is, so, and I'm playing devil's advocate here, so the Wall Street Journal publishes an article exposing this industry almost every day. On their front page, you know, Facebook tracks us, New York Times tracks us, online dictionaries track us. I just don't see, so for a year they've been doing that. I just don't see, like, do you think people are genuinely unaware that they're being tracked? And second, if those articles don't result, why don't those articles result in anything? Sure, you cannot boycott those companies, but you can go and pressure your, you know, lawmaker, whatever. I mean, you can see, I don't just see anything coming out of that, which makes me think there is not a problem of citizens and users being unaware, which would be very easy to solve by raising awareness. It's a problem of citizens and consumers actually buying it under this new paradigm and saying that, well, whatever, I'll get free music from Facebook if I share my data, and I don't care about the consequences.
So two of the journalists who write the privacy series for the What They Know series in the Journal are they're in the front row, and they were both nominated for a Pulitzer today, so congratulations. Or they were finalists, rather, sorry. So as much as I think they would probably wish that they had 300 million subscribers, they don't. And most consumers don't read the Wall Street Journal. The two leading groups that seem to read the Wall Street Journal are members of Congress and class action lawyers.
It's the highest distribution. It has the highest circulation of all newspapers.
But the highest circulation is still not a majority of the public. And so there was a great study done by Alicia McDonald, who's a researcher now at Berkeley, I think, or maybe Stanford. And she showed that 50% of consumers, 50% of Gmail users don't realize that their ads are targeted based on their email. And that's where the ads are on the right-hand side of the page based on the content of the email. 50% of consumers don't realize that. I mean, we have to deal with the fact that most consumers don't understand as much about technology as we do and don't understand the quid pro quo deals that have become the dominant business model in Silicon Valley. We have to understand that consumers don't understand this stuff. And I think...
See, my fear is that once consumers understand and do nothing, then we have a much more serious problem.
Well, that's a different story.
Let me jump in here because I want to get to one other interest group that needs to know more, and then we'll open the floor to questions. There was a great post, I can't even remember where I found it, during the SOPA debate, which basically the title says everything, which is, Dear Congress, it's no longer okay to not know how the internet works. Let me throw this to Elaine first. What do you think Congress needs to know that they don't know now about this debate? In general, the privacy debate.
You just said they didn't know anything about the internet, so I was wanting to make sure I understood which question you were asking.
What do you wish Congress knew? What do you wish Congress understood about how the internet works that they don't seem to currently?
I don't know if it's that Congress doesn't understand how the internet works or Congress is just trying to figure out how best to approach the advances in technology and the concerns expressed with the ability to ensure that, you know, law enforcement is able to do what they're doing. So I'm not quite sure it's quite the way you phrase the question.
Okay. So at the Jones oral arguments, the first question out of Justice Roberts' mouth when after the government's attorney started speaking was, wait a second, you're telling me that you can track us justices, you can track our movements without a warrant? And he was shocked by the government's answer. And I think if the Supreme Court is shocked at the ease with which the government can monitor us, I think probably members of Congress would be too, if they realized.
I don't know if the Supreme Court was shocked, since they, you know, they did ask other questions, and even in their opinion they showed that. So, and I want to make sure we understand that that was tracking, if we were tracking movements, those were movements that were in the public view.
Over 60 days, everywhere you go.
I don't know about 60 days. In that particular case, it's 28.
Sorry, 28, it's 60 days in the Fifth Circuit case, but.
Okay.
Jane, what do you wish Congress knew or understood about the internet that it doesn't seem to currently?
I'm not sure what I want Congress to know, but I'd like to sort of respond to the idea that, yeah, so I actually agree with Chris that I don't think the consumers understand the quid pro quo agreement that they're getting into as they use the internet. And I also, I do think that companies could, if they were induced or inclined to do so, educate the consumer more by providing, you know, accurate notice about the types of information that they're actually collecting. And contrary to all the other views I've expressed today, I actually do see some validity to trying to understand or trying to draw a line, a principled line, between information that we didn't really mean to expose to anyone or any company and information that we have voluntarily exposed to some other party. When we voluntarily expose it, that's where I, you know, that's where my laissez-faire attitude sort of jumps in. When we don't know that we're exposing it, which is describes most people as they're surfing the internet, I think things are very different. But what I've wanted industry to do, so maybe not Congress, but what I've wanted industry though to do is to actually accurately educate consumers by allowing them not only to opt out of tracking, but to show the consequences. I want somebody who opts out and isn't lazy like I am to have to see more commercials on Hulu than I do, since I'm sort of like, you know, I guess contributing my data to their data empires.
You're complaining that people who opt out right now get a free ride without any pain?
Well, I'm saying this would be a simultaneous way to opt out, to educate the user, to show that this is, you know, you are giving up, you're relinquishing your information about what exactly you're watching, without forcing industry to pull everyone together and to treat everyone equally. There have been proposals, I'm not sure if anyone here espouses them, but there have been proposals that everyone should be treated the same and we should have an ability to opt out. If we're treated differentially based on how much information we're relinquishing, then I think that could be a way to both educate the consumer and keep industry happy.
Let me hold on before I throw it to Evgeny. We do have about 15 minutes for questions, so if you have a question, I would urge you, while Evgeny's speaking, to wander up to the microphone.
So I think I want to clarify what I've said and link it to both Jane and Chris. So I think we should distinguish, if we don't already, between letting users know how they're being tracked and hoping that they understand what risks that tracking involves. And I think we will hardly ever achieve the second objective, in part because, and that's why we wouldn't see much action happen, because even if consumers understand that they're being tracked by 50 different websites or services, if they don't understand where that data adds up, how it's being collected, how it's being mined, put together, and then who has access to it, showing them that they're being tracked will not help, because they accept the bargain. They said, we're being tracked because we think it's harmless. So in that sense, I don't think that just sticking disclosures and saying that, well, you see Google ads because we analyze your email would be of great help, unless you show what the ultimate risks of that is, where the data ends up, who has access to it, and what consequences you'll have in your life based on the release of the data. So in that sense, I think we do have to differentiate between, on the one hand, you know, releasing and exposing the tracking practices, which is fine, I'm all for. I just don't think that it immediately follows that consumers will reject that, because they don't grasp, I think, and even I don't grasp where my data ends up and how it's going to be used against me in 30 or 20 or even 5 years. So from that perspective, I think we'll have to rely on science fiction to make this argument. By the way, you should all go and check a book called The Silicon Jungle, which is written by a Google engineer who works on data mining, published by Princeton University Press. The best novel about data mining you will ever read, and probably the only one. But it shows the risks very well. It actually builds on that case I mentioned about terrorists and bots. You should all go read it. It articulates the dangers really well.
I feel like I know what I want, and I also know that I will never get it from Google and Facebook, is that the option to make a commercial decision to opt out of being tracked. I understand that companies need to make money on the web. I understand it painfully from my own company. But I would like the ability to pay $10, $50 in exchange for using a service in a completely private way so that I don't have to...
What if I don't have $20 to pay?
Well, that's... Okay. We're going to get into that.
Like, again, it's a very neoliberal outlook, which is fine for someone who works at Bloomberg Business Week, but...
what exactly are these risks? Could you give me an example of the type of risk that you fear that we would all recognize as harm that ought to be prevented and not,
Jane, I'm going to stomp on Evgeny's answer because we've got three people. We've got six people, 15 questions, and they will prevent me from having to respond at length about my neoliberal outlook.
So just a quick
say who you are first, real quick, and then.
My name is Ashkan Sultani. I'm an independent researcher in this space. Just a quick comment and then a question on the paying $50 or being forced to see more ads if you opt out or longer ads, et cetera. I would probably take that bargain if it meant that every time my data was reused, each time I would then get subsequent payout for it, right? But what happens is upon a single disclosure, that data has infinite reuse and value. Or if I pay $50 for a service, oftentimes, actually most times, paid services provide no additional privacy protections than free services, right? So if we came to a world that exists, I think that thinking could work, but it actually, we're not there yet, right? So there's no restrictions on secondary use of any data or any limitations.
Capitalist.
Exactly.
Sorry, go ahead.
My question, though, is kind of closer to the kind of focusing on the U.S. versus Jones interpretation of trespass and around this statement that was made earlier around technical capabilities, right? And kind of touching on what Evgeny and Chris were talking about regarding malware, installation of malware, or tracking location. So on this device, I can swap my SIM card quite easily. So I can use multiple SIM cards, and law enforcement loses the technical capability to track me across multiple cell phone providers unless you guys have to deal with each one. Right, so you'd have to subpoena each cell phone provider for my location and tower data. You could simply, and as we know has been done, install malware, which requires, or not even install malware, but get me to either click on a screensaver app that actually has some phone home capabilities, or get Google to push software to my phone, which they have the ability to do. And that requires no trespass, right? So that requires no physical access to my device, right? And so I know you can't say the opinion of the commission or the agency, but I'd love to know what you think, kind of where the line draws in terms of putting software on my phone that allows you to track me, given that you don't have or may not have easy technical capability to do me through to track me through standard, cell tower data. So there's no physical access. Do you need what's the standard under Jones for you?
So if we don't have trespass, then the concurrence in Jones would talk about length of time of acquiring data of individuals. And as we said, the Supreme Court, we definitely know 28 days is not good. We don't know what else is. But I think we also have to determine what it is that we are trying to acquire if we do that. And other things might come into play, right? So if we are trying to collect real-time information, then we'll need a warrant. So there are other things that come into play. So it's not just the Jones case that would govern that particular situation.
So let me ask a quick clarifying question. So there's an FBI program called CPAV, which is the new name for the Blue Lantern, I think, or Magic Lantern. And this is the FBI's malware and spyware software suite. And so it sounds like what you're saying is if the government is using CPAV or some other software solution to obtain basic subscriber information or something that the government could normally get with a subpoena, that you can use malware to get that information with a subpoena. Do you not need a warrant to insert the software on the device in the first place?
It all depends on the circumstance of what we're doing at that particular moment. Yep.
So can you send a user an infected file that takes over their device and it just obtains basic subscriber information with a subpoena?
Send malware with just a subpoena?
Yes.
What do you think the answer is?
I think it's probably yes, but I'd love to find out what the answer is. That's why I'm asking you.
Not sure. Don't think so.
I think that Elaine and Chris should host a morning show together.
We should.
Next question.
Yeah, hi. My name is Jacob Applebaum, and I'm one of the people being investigated by the grand jury for WikiLeaks, and I've been detained probably about 14 times at the border, so I know a little bit about the FBI, and it's a pleasure to be on this side of the table for once. I'm a computer hacker, and I help people in places like Egypt and Syria and Iran and Tunisia to overthrow their governments because they are not governments which essentially grant their authority from people's consent in a democratic way. And I really firmly believe that that is important. And the State Department has funded the Tor project, which we work on. This is a thing that essentially helps those totalitarian governments to go dark, because those governments don't have legitimate authority. And I wonder why it is that you in the FBI and basically the rest of the US government make their job pretty much, I don't want to say that it's easy. It still takes some technical ability. But why is it that you push for surveillance equipment, which where the C in Kalia actually could stand for Chinese instead of what it's actually called? Why is it that you push for things that I can hack here? I mean, I can intercept your cell phone calls. I have a $20 phone in my backpack. I can use it to track you. I can listen to all your communications. Why is it that you allow American businessmen and women abroad to be insecure? And yet at the same time, you fund, essentially, the work that I do in a roundabout way so that activists won't be harmed by states that act the way that you do towards me. And that's not a loaded question.
No.
Yes, it is.
But why is it that you, for example, are you willing to keep all of America's businessmen and women insecure in order to maintain your so-called lawful interception capabilities? Is that a trade-off you're willing to make? Because I tell you, I sort of like it as a computer hacker. Can you promise to keep it?
You've asked about three questions. We're gonna pause while she answers one of them.
Sure.
At least one of them. Okay. I'm only going to speak for the FBI. I'm not going to speak for the United States government. And so what I'm going to say is that the C in Kalia does not stand for China. And contrary to what people may believe, we as law enforcement, we as an intelligence community who have been given the mission to protect this country from threats, need to be able to work with those providers to have a technical solution. The orders we get are lawful. We go to a court. We have a judge sign off on them if we present the appropriate information for them to do so. And so that's what we are empowered to do. I cannot speak for those who commit criminal acts and who are willing to, you know, do that. I can only speak for what we're trying to do, which is protect this country with the proper authorities and the capabilities to do so.
And just as a clarifying question, are you including national security letters in your comment about believing that there is judicial oversight with the FBI's actions?
National security letters, administrative subpoenas have the ability to have judicial oversight, yes.
How many of those actually do have judicial oversight in percentage?
What do you mean by that? How many have?
Every time you get a national security letter, you have to go to a judge? Or?
No. As you well know, national security letters, just like administrative subpoenas, you don't have to go to a judge. The statute does allow for the person on whom those are served to seek judicial review. And people have done so.
And in the case of the third parties, such as, say, the 2703D orders that were served on my, according to the Wall Street Journal, my Gmail account, my Twitter account, and my internet service provider account, the third parties were prohibited from telling me about it. So how am I supposed to go to a judge if the third party is gagged from telling me that I'm targeted by you?
There are times when we have to have those things in place. So at some point, obviously you became aware, so at some point the person does become aware. But yes, the statute does allow us to do that. The statute allows us.
Do you believe that legal and illegal are the same as right and wrong?
I'm going to let her think for a second. I'm going to cut you off after this one because we got about four people behind you.
While she's thinking, let me just say that Jake was lucky enough to use companies that fought for the right to tell him about the requests. And the common practice amongst telecommunications carriers like AT&T and Verizon is to never tell their users about the requests that they receive. And so if the government sends a subpoena to AT&T for your data, you won't hear about it. I mean, in many strange ways, Google is actually good in privacy in this area. I wish they wouldn't keep any data, but that clashes with their business model. But the fact that Jake was lucky enough to use Google, or maybe not Google, at least Twitter.
It was a choice. I did it so that everyone would know what was happening. I didn't use it for anything interesting. Just so you know, if your fishing expeditions eventually do work out, there's nothing there. It was just to get you to show the rest of the world that you're fascists.
Whoa.
Crowd, huh?
No, word tough doesn't come to mind.
Hi there. So my name is Nadim. I'm a programmer. It seems to me that the internet is basically divided into two parts right now, which is there's one part that uses Google Docs, and you have your Word documents and your PowerPoint stored on Google, and that's fine. And there's another part that uses encryption technologies like PGP for everything. And then instead of storing, you know, a Word document on Google Docs, they send it to communicate it to each other in other ways that are encrypted, you know, locally, so that they don't store it in plain text in other areas. And so when there's a law enforcement agency that wants to intercept both of these use cases, the Google Docs interception is, you know, easily possible, and you just go to Google and you grab the document. Where the other part, the PGP part, requires more effort, since there's very strong encryption going on there most of the time. But I have a suspicion that within the next, say, 10 years, there will be a point where the internet technology will evolve in such a way that even the people who are using Google Docs to store, you know, even the majority, 90% of the people who just use Google, you know, the cloud for, you know, Google Docs and stuff like that, will also automatically be using client-side encryption in one way or another, so that Google itself only receives and exchanges already encrypted Google Docs. And so this is a situation where the world entirely now is part of the second half, the encrypted half, whether they like it or not, whether they know how to use encryption or not, no matter who they are, no matter how they work. And the encryption would work in such a way that Google only stores ciphertext ever to which they never have the key to, because the encryption is never done by Google. The encryption is done locally, transparently. And so from there...
Why would Google do that?
Simply because I have an impression, and I might be wrong, but I have an impression that there are people at Google who would rather deal away with this entire privacy thing. And just because, I mean, Google doesn't really benefit from your Google Docs monetarily. Your Word, I mean...
Yet.
Yet, but...
Well, let me give you... So take an example. So 3 weeks ago, Google was granted a patent to use your mobile phone to monitor your environment, to basically listen in to any noise, to record the temperature, to record the lighting conditions, and then to potentially serve you ads based on that data. So it is in Google's business model, and it's in their business interest to record and decrypt everything. I just don't see, I mean, I see a lot of good, smart, privacy-minded activists within Google who would want to encrypt everything. But that goes directly against how Google makes their money, which is they look at your data and they serve you an ad.
Mm-hmm. And this is, in fact, something that one of Google's top executives, Vint Cerf, the inventor of TCP/IP, said at the Internet Governance Forum in Nairobi last year on a panel that I was at. He said, we couldn't run our system if everything in it were encrypted in storage, because then we wouldn't know which ads to show you. This is a system that was designed around a particular business model. Mm-hmm. I think that Google and Microsoft and some of the other cloud computing companies might deploy strong, fully encrypted technologies at some point for business customers. Okay. But the consumers who are getting services in an ad-supported manner, they're not going to get strong client-side encrypted data anytime soon.
See, the thing is, I would never suggest that Google would deploy automatic, you know, easy, accessible encryption like that to email. This is something that would never happen. But there are some things that are both valuable, just like PowerPoint presentations that are, I mean, it's possible like...
Valuable?
Well...
Google's not a charity. Right, and that's something that has been made perfectly clear to me by executives from Google and Microsoft. They're not a charity. They're in the business of providing services in exchange for user data. There may be individual engineers who would like to see stuff encrypted in storage, but one thing that you should know by now is that engineers don't decide which code ships. Lawyers and business people do, and they're not going to allow those products to see the light of day.
And I think under the new privacy policy at Google, they can actually track what you type in Google Documents to serve you better ads on search. Wouldn't that be the implication of the new privacy policy? They can track what you do across any service and then customize ads based on that. So whatever you type in Google Docs, you would be able to process and analyze it and serve you a better ad on Gmail or on Google Search? I mean, it's a possibility. So the fact that they don't show you ads on Google Docs doesn't mean that that data would not be incorporated into showing you better ads on other Google services.
So you believe this obstacle is insurmountable and will result in that specific vision of the future to never be...
No, I mean, there are all sorts of companies. I mean, Chris and Jake sit on the advisory board of a new ISP that, you know, would charge users and offer them a more secure experience. I mean, there are all sorts of initiatives. I just don't see that happen as a Google or Facebook service, because it just goes against how they make their money.
If you want a company to protect your privacy, you're going to need to write them a check each month. And as long as you're not writing Google a check, they're not going to deploy that kind of technology. I'm sorry to say.
So you're neoliberal as well?
I mean, I think that companies that extract revenue from user data, I think their business model is fundamentally at odds with protecting users from the government.
Let me jump in here. We've got about 15 minutes more for questions, right? Could we go that long? Maybe about... looks like we have about 2 minutes left for questions. But let me just throw in before we go to, let's move to the next question. Let me throw in real quickly that you could make an argument that Elaine is responsible for what happened to Jake. You could make a similar argument that I, as an employee of Bloomberg, am responsible for the fact that New Yorkers can't smoke in bars. So she's come with no notice to a pretty hostile audience, and I think that we should afford her the respect based on that decision. But please go ahead and ask your question.
Yes, so my name is Denver Gingrich. I am a software engineer. I work at the Software Freedom Conservancy. And my question kind of stems from this centralization of data that you're all referring to. So you've mentioned that that people choose to use Facebook and Gmail and Twitter and all these other products. And by them using it, this data becomes centralized, and because there are these conduits through which the data can be reported to government, it makes makes it very hard to maintain your privacy in that way. And so I was wondering if you could comment on some of the other initiatives, and by comment I mean specifically say how feasible you think they are and if there are any we should be watching out for, some of the initiatives that that serve a similar purpose but are less conducive to this sort of tracking. And I'm thinking specifically about services like Identica, which is a microblogging tool like Twitter, which you can run on your own server, and so you can control your own data there, and it federates with other services that people are running on their own computers as well. And so I was just wondering if you could kind of just, you know, say what you think about these sorts of efforts and whether you think they have any chance of taking off. And I think this will likely get back into the money situation. Someone's got to run it. But I'm thinking, you know, maybe if enough people have become aware of this, that it's something that that could take off. And if you guys agree with this.
No. So Google likes to say that their competition is just one click away. But social products use social methods to encourage you to use them, right? There's the network effect in Facebook. And so even if there is a truly privacy-preserving, fully encrypted, zero data retention social networking service that you pay for, if your friends aren't using them, it's not going to be very useful.
Right,
and so these other services engage in federation. They play well with others. But Twitter and Facebook aren't going to share their data with those services. In fact, Facebook has done everything possible to not have their data flow out of their silo. As long as Facebook is where all your friends are, that's where you have to be too. And that's, or you know, are ostracized and don't get invited to parties. That's really what happens.
I think just to respond to that, I think, of course, right now that is the situation. There are a much higher percentage of people on Facebook than on these other services. But I think over time that might flip, in which case you would have more people on these federated services. But I guess your opinion then would be that that's unlikely to happen in the near
future. You have Google with all their clout trying to launch Google Plus and not being extremely successful, to put it mildly. So I'm not sure that a regular startup, I mean, it's possible, but I wouldn't necessarily think it's likely that a startup would be able to provide the kind of community or network you get on Facebook.
Do you have any comments on the other side of the table?
I guess, Facebook certainly wasn't the first social network, and I'm not sure it'll be the last, although I think the business model problem looks like the bigger one to me. I don't see people paying for any service that they can get free basically ever. So I guess that's if they figure out how to make money, that's, you know, power to them.
Let me jump in. We've got time for one more question, then I have to wrap it up.
Okay. Can we just take two so that everyone gets to ask a question and then we'll choose who to ask what, because we only have two left.
Sure. Yeah.
So I'm Arturo Filastò, and I work on security and anonymity technologies. And I had a question regarding lawful interception. And so obviously, lawful interception comes with it, I hope you will agree, with a trade-off. Users are penalized sometimes because they are lawfully intercepted and their privacy is violated. And something, you know, that is something that is, you know, for sure not good. And because, you know, one understands that it was not the case that it was right, you know, correct to do that. And so I ask, what do you think the benefit that you have from making these more accessible and more easy and more widely deployed is actually positive? As in, does it actually bring a you know, more good than the damage that it does to innocent people?
Can we ask the second one so that we have both?
Sure.
Hi. So I. Hi. My name is Rose Regina. I'm an activist. I have a certain amount of experience with government surveillance, though thankfully not too much of it too close to home. But I do have friends and family members who were people who suffered consequences based on COINTELPRO. So it's really hard for me to hear that I'm just supposed to trust the government and that they're providing their own oversight when they're not even sharing facts and figures with the Senate and other parts of our government who we do have a little bit more ability to communicate and lobby. So I just wanted to make that comment. But additionally, I wanted to problematize what you were saying about wanting consumers to have to suffer or like watch more commercials.
I really should put that in the positive spin. You know, like
but I wanted to say that you missed a large part of why there isn't consumer pushback, like Evgeny was talking about, in terms of surveillance, is that on a certain level, many consumers benefit from that surveillance. They get things that are more appropriately tailored to them. They get commercials that are more likely to be like, hey, this is kind of entertaining, instead of, oh my God, no more baby food. I just don't care. I don't have kids. So there are things like that that I think are crucial to understanding the trade-offs and why I don't think you should just make me watch more commercials on Hulu. But I guess I mostly want to ask this end of the table, what you think it would take in terms of a critical event for consumers to actually start caring about privacy? Evgeny, you brought up cyber dystopianism and how much cyber dystopianism would have to manifest itself in order for people who don't have my experience and my background to actually start paying attention.
Let me jump in real quick. We have until at the very latest 7:45 because Elaine's gotta jump to catch a plane.
So I'm gonna answer both. Well, I'm gonna answer one and comment on the second.
He's not reading, not me.
Is that okay? So the first question, I would start with the premise that lawful interception is that the statutes are designed to be privacy statutes. And so Congress put into place rules of the road for us to be able to acquire that information. And it provides, tells us what kind of information at what level we need to show to the court that we're entitled to that information. The statutes provide reporting back to the court on these type of things, and so there is that in play. So as law enforcement, as the agency with primary responsibility to combat terrorism, our ability to be able to acquire the information based on a court order is very important, and we have to be able to do that to meet our goals. As for the young lady, I don't know where she went. We do have oversight committees in Congress. They do ask us questions. They do ask us numbers, and we have to report and answer those questions and report those numbers. So it's not quite the fact that they don't have insight into what we do. So I think you see our director testifying many a times in front of Congress, both in open, and obviously you don't see him in the closed sessions, but you see him in both.
So the Pen Register Act, which is the means by which the government collects communications, non-content information, the who you've called, the who you've emailed, that kind of thing. The Pen Register statute requires that the Attorney General submit reports to Congress every year detailing how many pen registers were obtained by agencies within the Department of Justice in the previous year. Twice, for 4 or 5 year periods, DOJ didn't bother submitting any reports to Congress. The first time they sent, a 5-year dump of information, and then those were later obtained by EFF as part of a FOIA that they filed. And then a couple years ago, I got a second batch. DOJ assures me that they are now sending them every year. They blame the old administration, you know, those the folks who didn't care about privacy. But for the better part of 10 years, Congress simply didn't know how many pen registers were obtained each year by DOJ. And so I do push back on the idea that Congress is fully informed regarding the surveillance capabilities used by your agency and others.
So we're just talking pen registers, and I can't speak for the department, but we do report on other things, and pen registers do capture the phone numbers. We don't know what those numbers go to until we serve additional process on the companies.
Let me jump in, because I thought the last question was a really great one, because it kind of sums up the central problem that, that we haven't yet found an answer for, and I don't suspect that we will tonight. But I'm going to throw the last question to Evgeny, which is that it basically to repeat...
Is it revenge?
What? It is not revenge. I'll get my revenge later. I have a blog, Evgeny.
Damn, still?
It seems like there is some hope that that sunlight will be good for everybody. And I think that everybody at the table would agree with that in principle. And yet, there seems to be a somewhere along the line, it doesn't seem that everybody is completely confident that with more and more and more and more and more sunlight, there will eventually be a movement among consumers, among voters, to come to a compromise that everybody at this table might find reasonable. So I'll repeat her question. Do you think that there could be a catalyzing event that could take sunlight and turn it into some kind of consensus?
I think the only catalyzing events you can expect would be to justify the government grabbing even more power in terms of surveillance. So, you know, that proverbial, E-9-11 that Larry Lessig has been talking about for 10 years, I think that's much more likely to cause the very opposite. I don't see, you know, no matter how much data, consumer data gets out, and now it's anonymous, you know, in other movements, you see consumer data get out almost every day. I don't see much happening, in part because you have banking and insurance industry underwrite all those losses, so in fact, few suffer the consequences. So I, you know, with personal data, of course, it can be different, so there will be emotional cost. I don't see an event. Furthermore, to respond to the question, I don't see any theory of, you know, cyber dystopianism contribute anything to this debate, unfortunately, or at least have much of an impact. I think fundamentally, we need a new way to talk about privacy, which will require a new theory of privacy, which will require going beyond the standard liberal framework of let's just assume citizens are autonomous and they can do whatever they want. I think there will need to be a lot of intellectual changes before we start recognizing the threats. And right now, if all we say is that we just need to make sure users are aware, like I don't think we'll get very far, because that relies on the assumption of autonomy that I'm not sure is always there.
Let me thank Evgeny Morozov for my monthly helping of dystopia, and also Chris Segoyan and Elaine Lambert and Jane Yakowitz for helping us out tonight.